This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Defense attorney extraordinaire Alan Dershowitz has defended some mighty controversial defendants in his time. Mike Tyson, O.J. Simpson, Leona Helmsley, Klaus von Bülow. Now Dershowitz is flying to the defense of another super hot potato, preemption, preemptive war, preemptive detention, preemptive restraint of free speech, and more. For a famed defender of civil liberties, this can sound like heresy. With the Iraq mess and Guantanamo and NSA wiretap fury, it can sound oblivious to preemption's downside. Yes, says Dershowitz, it cuts both ways. But we're already in the age of preemption, and we'd better learn how to live with it. Up next on Point, Alan Dershowitz on the age of preemption. Joining me now in the studio is Alan Dershowitz. He is a professor at Harvard Law School and one of the country's most celebrated defense attorneys, and an all-round big thinker. His new book is Preemption, A Knife That Cuts Both Ways. Alan Dershowitz, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me on this wonderful show.
So here we are. You're making a great big case for preemption, for debate around preemption, mm-hmm. for building a framework, a new jurisprudence, as you describe it, for preemption. And you can just feel the apprehension out there. I mean, looking at Iraq. Yesterday, the president saying we've come to a moment of choice. Mm-hmm. They can choose unity or chaos. And what chaos would mean there, God knows. The head of intelligence, Negroponte, saying we could see regional meltdown. You've seen the international opprobrium we've suffered for Guantanamo, whether it's good mm-hmm. or bad. It's bad for the reputation at the moment. Is it a bad time to be coming out with a book for preemption?
No, it's the perfect time, because if my jurisprudence of preemption had been in place and had been followed, we would not have gone to war in Iraq. We would not have built Guantanamo. We would not be doing the current National Security Council's data mining. What I'm calling for is a jurisprudence, that is, a way of cabining a phenomenon that is in existence and will remain in existence and will be used more and more and more. Look, my life work has always been to look at phenomena out there, many of them I don't agree with and don't like, and say, hey, they're operating outside the legal system in an ad hoc way. Let's create a jurisprudence. Many people oppose that, and they say, no. If they're operating outside the legal system, let's keep them outside the legal system. Two types of people take that view, one who want to keep doing it and one who don't want to legitimate it. Mm-hmm. And I've always taken the opposite view. If we're doing it and if it looks like we're going to continue to do it in a systematic way, let's create a jurisprudence around it. Let's say when it's permissible and when it's not permissible. Look, everybody in the world favors some preemption and some prevention. There is not a thinking person who would not today in retrospect say that we should not have engaged in preventive war against Nazi Germany in the 1930s, which Winston Churchill wanted to do and Chamberlain did not. If the British and the French and maybe even the Americans had attacked Nazi Germany and destroyed their war machine in 36 or 37, as Goebbels, by the way, in his diary said, all the Nazis believed would happen, we'd never have seen the Second World War. Now, the interesting thing is we'd never know what we prevented. The history books would say, oh, my God, look, Britain and France, once again, after winning the First World War and imposing a humiliating Versailles Treaty on Germany,
trumped all over Europe,
just went all over and beat back this tin horn dictator named Hitler, who probably wasn't even going to be reelected again in 1938. So you never know what you're going to do when you preempt.
But the other side of that, and you point to it yourself in the book, is that Hitler and his crew themselves were kind of dark mm-hmm. masters of preemption.
Of course.
They were sterilizing hundreds of thousands of people. We know what happened in the Holocaust. These were, in their minds, a kind of preemption. You say yourself that this is an approach that has long been associated with tyrannical
Absolutely.
Regimes.
That's
so how
right.
do you touch preemption and not get into the tar pit of tyranny?
You do, and that's why you need a jurisprudence. That's why you have to argue that some preemption is terrible and must be stopped, and some preemption is desirable. Look, to say you're against preemption is like saying you're against punishment. Punishment's been misused. We hate the way punishment is used in many parts of the world. We hate the way dictators have used punishment after the fact. And preemption has been misused. But, for example, humanitarian preemption is something that we have to do more of. If we had engaged in preemptive activities in Darfur or in Cambodia or in the former Yugoslavia or in other places where genocide had occurred, I think many progressive people would say that was a wonderful thing. In fact, there are two kinds of preemption. There's kind of progressive liberal preemption, which the conservatives hate and liberals love. Let's go in there and stop people from
Madeleine Albright,
others.
Why do we have this great army if we're not going to use it
right.
in the Balkans?
And then there's the hawkish preemption, which the liberals and progressives hate. Let's go into Iraq. Look, Iraq was not a preemptive war. It was a preventive war. And I want to make a distinction between the two. Preemption is when something is absolutely imminent. Mm-hmm. Israel, 1967, sees the massing armies of Syria and Egypt, and it decides to strike the first blow. Most of the world accepts that. That's preemptive attack. Preemption is different. We see Iraq building up perhaps weapons of mass destruction. Many of us believe that, although I was opposed to the war in Iraq even before it began. And we say, look, this is a good time to strike them before they get strong. That's preventive, and that's more long-term, and that's always going to be much harder to justify.
And you're saying build a jurisprudence right. for both. It's going to make people nervous. You build a gallows, you're mm-hmm. going to hang people.
Mm-hmm.
What's the framework you're talking about? What do you mean by building a jurisprudence for preemption?
Well, I'd rather have a gallows on which we hang people than allow people just to kill each other in retaliation. The gallows was a step forward. In fact, the first law of the Bible people forget is, he who sheds human blood shall by humans have his blood be shed. It was a civilizing approach, anachronistic today, and we want to see it come to an end. But if there are gallows out there, I sure want to know when we can use it and when we can't.
You say,
and
right now it's ad hoc. It's happening all over the place.
It's happening all over. We're using it. We're racially profiling. That's a form of preemption.
We are? Who? How? Where?
Of course we are. And without any question, when
where?
We decide, look, if even look at the issue of the whether or not the United Arab Emirates are going to run our ports. That's a form of ethnic profiling. The opposition to it is, oh my God, they're Arabs, they're Muslims. They must be, you fill in the blank, and we can't let them run our ports.
So you say. Others would disagree, but okay, we hear it. What else?
When we selectively detain people after 9/11, we didn't selectively detain people who looked like you and me. We selectively detained people who looked Asian and Arab and Muslim. And we used immigration law selectively, material witness law selectively. All of these were forms of preventive detention.
So it's going on, you're saying, and on many other fronts. But what do you mean by a jurisprudence, then, of preemption?
Well, you know, when the framers of our Constitution looked around and saw there were general searches going on and looked around and saw there were terrible evils going on, they created the Bill of Rights. That's a jurisprudence. It said, yes, you can conduct searches, but only if there's probable cause and only if they're not unreasonable. We have a jurisprudence for how to punish people after the fact. Better 10 guilty go free than even one innocent be wrongly confined. We have no such quantification or even beginning of a quantification for how many people should we be able to detain based on suspicion in order to prevent what kind of terrorist attack of what magnitude and what imminence. We need to begin to talk about prediction and prevention in the way we have for thousands of years been talking about after the fact.
You mean put numbers on it? In other words, if we were looking at a threat of X magnitude, that mm-hmm. means we can justify putting 300 innocents in jail to find the one who might perpetrate that atrocity.
We never want to put a single innocent in jail. What we say is let's...
Preventive detention is jail.
No, I'm saying that, but we never want to put innocents in jail. What we want to do is try to spot the terrorists as they're planning the terrorism, hope not to get any innocents, but we know for sure that a certain number will be innocent. We also know that when we punish after the fact, a certain number will be innocent. We don't require the jury to find proof to a certainty.
But do you mean formulas would be written into law?
Well,
in such
like,
a circumstance, we'll accept, though we don't like it, we'll accept 400 in Guantanamo for one or none or whatever the number
no,
is.
No, but we might do the following. We might say, following 9/11, it is not a terrible thing to detain for a period of 1 month everybody who is out of status with their immigration in order to investigate to see whether any of them poses a severe enough risk of terrorism. After 1 month, however, we've already made the balance and struck the balance. Probably 1 month is too much. We then release them. We have to strike a balance. What we're doing now is not striking a balance at all. We're saying detain them. There are no limits. Guantanamo is a black hole. There's no law that operates there. We're discussing whether to bomb Iran preemptively. Nobody knows what the appropriate criteria would be. When might it be appropriate?
We'll look at how you would judge that.
Bombing.
So what else? Preemptive war? Preventive detention. What else?
Preventive inoculation. If we knew, for example, that smallpox had been weaponized, we could prevent that from becoming an effective weapon if we inoculated everybody. But for every million people we inoculate, 600 of them will suffer serious injuries. Some
or
will
death.
Die.
And we know that in advance, you're saying,
sure.
but for the greater good, we would do it. What else?
We do that all the time.
Force it, in other words.
We do that all the time.
What else?
Sex psychopath laws are now being enacted in places like New York, where we're going to confine people not on the basis necessarily of what they've done, because they've already been punished for that, but on the basis of what we think they will do in the future, because we believe sexual criminals have a high rate of recidivism, and people who rape and people who molest children.
So across
can't
a
be
huge
trusted.
Front, tapping, wiretapping,
wire
the NSA
tapping
wiretapping. What about the Bill of Rights? Does such a framework, a jurisprudence of preemption, can it coexist, or do we have to tear up the Bill of Rights to do this? And if we do, what?
No, of course. I would begin to build our framework on the Bill of Rights. The Fourth Amendment talks about searches that must be not unreasonable. The Fifth Amendment prohibits a coercive interrogation. Those are bedrocks. The First Amendment prohibits censorship of free speech. But let me.
But are you reinterpreting them so thoroughly that the original meaning is drained away?
Well, I'd rather look at see how the Bill of Rights applies than ignore what we're doing now is ignoring the Bill of Rights, saying there's no relevance whatsoever. And the reason for it is this. We now have a new phenomenon, the suicide terrorist. The suicide terrorist can't be deterred. Oh, of course, the suicide bomber could be deterred. We can't say to the suicide bomber, we'll kill you if we catch you, because he's prepared to die. If we wanted to adopt tyrannical principles of the kind that Stalin and Hitler used, we could employ Zippenhof, that is punishment of kin. We could say, if you blow yourself up, we will kill your relatives.
We'll find your parents, your kids.
That has been done in the past. It is alleged the KGB did that in Lebanon when one of their diplomats was captured. They moved in the 1980s and killed the family of those who had kidnapped the diplomat, and it was never repeated again. We can't do that in a democracy.
Period. End of story.
Right. So how do you, if you can't deter the suicide bomber, obviously you have to stop him before he engages in the suicide bombing. And that poses very, very daunting problems. And by the way, if Clinton had been president rather than Bush and 9/11 had occurred, Clinton would have said the same thing that Bush said. We have to move the Justice Department toward preventing recurrence of 9/11 rather than just punishment.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not a liberal Democrat phenomenon. How do you deal with people who are prepared to die, who expect to get the 72 virgins in heaven? Now, obviously, if we could persuade some of the imams to reinterpret the text and say you don't get 72 virgins in heaven, you get just one 72-year-old virgin in heaven, maybe we could persuade them to stop. But we're not going to influence them in that way. And if you just look at in one of your earlier shows today, there was talk about the cartoons and the way in which people got inflamed over the cartoons.
So what are you saying to the Danes? Don't publish those cartoons?
Let me tell you that there are those out there who are now saying that before you publish cartoons like that, you have to go through a prior censorship process. I would be very much against that in the United States. But the president of Pakistan said on your program today he would like to see the UN pass laws prohibiting the publication of blasphemous cartoons. We can't accept that in the United States. We live by the Bill of Rights.
But you're talking about preventive restraint,
right.
Prior restraint on free speech. You're saying it has to be considered.
Well, it has been considered. We have used prior restraint on free speech on numerous occasions in our past history. I would be very much against that. But what if you had a situation where the names of spies or the names of secret installations where we keep our most important weapons were about to be disclosed? Today, the Constitution would be construed to permit prior restraint of that kind of speech. Remember, it came awfully close in the New York Times Pentagon Papers case. The only reason the Supreme Court in a close decision said prior restraint was not possible is because we know the address of the New York Times and the Washington Post, and we can go after them once the publication has occurred. With the internet, we don't have home addresses anymore. And so there is a movement out there for prior restraint of speech, a movement that I strongly oppose. So don't confuse wanting to build a jurisprudence of preemption with supporting preemption in all instances. I am generally opposed to current uses of preemption. I favor some of them, and I think most people favor some of them, and I want to see us have this debate rather than just leaving it to the ad hoc decisions of those in power.
But you do kind of say if you build it, they will come. You describe the current Security Council law as benighted here because it's all based on deterrence.
It's terrible.
But I can't help wondering— if the potential for abuse here is not so large.
It's very large.
That, I mean, wouldn't the founding fathers turn over in their graves? You're taking the Bill of Rights and saying, yeah,
no,
but we're going to reinterpret what these things mean.
The founding fathers passed the Alien and Sedition Act at the first threat to America. The very people who wrote the Bill of Rights in 1793, within a decade, voted for the Alien and Sedition Act. And by the way, the only reason Thomas Jefferson opposed the Alien and Sedition Act, he wanted to see censorship and prior restraint done by the states, not the federal government. He was an anti-federalist. So you can't invoke the founding fathers. The founding fathers jumped at the first fear of a French invasion and basically abrogated the Bill of Rights. I think we have to be better than the founding fathers.
But is there some dark kind of presumption in here? I mean, I'm reading, we talked not so long ago with Zbigniew Brzezinski. He got this book out, The Choice. And he says that there are times when you've got to, you know, when the threat is imminent, preemption's got to be there, but be careful, he
says. Be careful, I say,
too. He says, the worst effect of such far-reaching alteration in alliances and doctrine could be on America itself. It would transform both America's historical role in the world and the way the world views it. Rather than continue as the beacon of liberty for the politically awakening peoples, it would become the leader of a new holy alliance, lacking balance, concern for order and justice, security and democracy.
I hear the violins playing as he says that. That is total nonsense. That kind of claptrap word. If Brzezinski were here, I'd say to him, all right, so what if you had a chance to prevent the genocide in Darfur by sending American troops in unilaterally because the UN didn't do anything? Would you do it or wouldn't you do it? And suddenly we'd hear the same glorious words with the violins in the background justifying American force and American intervention. So sometimes it is justified, sometimes it's not. We knew for sure that an enemy of the United States was about to launch a nuclear bomb on New York, there isn't a single political figure in the world who wouldn't launch a preemptive attack to stop that from happening. And the UN charter that says you cannot use armed forces until you are attacked first is anachronistic, which is why no country in the world follows it. As Dean Acheson says, a nation's survival is not a matter of law.
And yet here's another angle of pushback. Maybe you agree with this, but the Economist this week, they've got an editorial here. They say, of course, the U.S., the Bush administration now calls the long war.
Right.
The Economist says, why is this going to take so long to win? And they're saying, because this administration, in their words, still doesn't get it. What don't they get? They said, no amount of spin will make locking people up indefinitely without trial at Guantanamo Bay look compatible with American principles
of
justice.
That's right.
And on they go.
That's
to say,
why we should be against it.
In its great struggle against Soviet communism, a far more potent foe than Islamist extremism, America stood firmly on the side of human rights and freedom. Unless it stands credibly on that side again, winning this fight will take far longer than it should do.
Okay, let's first of all talk about how we dealt with the Soviet threat in this paradigm of wonderful democracy. We built a whole preventive detention law, the McCarran Act, which in fact we built concentration camps in the middle of the country, which permitted on a state of war. This was passed by Truman, supported by Senator Douglas. I have references to it in my book, Preemption and Knife, that cuts that both ways. We had a whole system of preventive detention planned for the first moment when the Soviet Union, shook their impotent hand at us. We never had to use it. McCarthyism was a form of preemption and preventive detention in the war against the Soviet Union. So let's not glorify
those rejected
American involvement.
But deterrence was clearly the cornerstone
of
Cold War.
No, I don't agree with that.
Wow.
Deterrence was the cornerstone of our nuclear policy. Why? Because we had shown our credibility in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We were prepared to bomb cities and kill millions of people. If we didn't have that credible threat, it wouldn't have worked. And remember, too, that early on in the Cold War, there were those who wanted to preempt. Fortunately, they didn't. I think deterrence works when you're dealing with a rational, calculating leader. But what if you're dealing with the president of Iran, who said that if Iran does get the nuclear bomb, they will drop it on Tel Aviv and kill 3 million Jews. The Israelis will then retaliate and kill 20 million people in Tehran. And the trade-off will be worth it because there are more Muslims than Jews in the world. You're the prime minister of Israel. You sit back and say, you know, that's a fair trade-off. Let's do it. Let's kill 20 million instead of 3 million. Or if you have a chance to take out their nuclear capacity, as Israel did with Iraq in 1981, killing one person in the process, do you take a preemptive strike as you did in Osirik? These are hard questions that we need to debate.
And serious people coming down on both sides.
Absolutely.
Many saying you can't go in and be bombing Iran here. We've got Alan Dershowitz with us.
I'm one of them, by the way. I don't think we should be bombing Iran. I don't think that's the right case for the use of preemption.
Iraq might have
been in 81.
The new book is Preemption, A Knife That Cuts Both Ways. He says, but he would use it, but careful, wisely, he says. Let's invite our callers in. Matt is calling from Alexandria, Virginia. Matt, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to thank Mr. Dershowitz for taking this stand, and I wanted to say that I support you for launching the forum and the means for the country to debate this. I don't know where to draw the lines on the issues that you describe, but I'm worried that America has gotten a faint of heart and used to not having to face very serious issues like this and make adult decisions about it.
So, Matt, are you worried at all that civil liberties will get crunched in this shift or not?
I am, but I'm more worried about the results that will happen if we don't.
I'm worried about civil liberties being squashed too, and we should have worried about it when, for example, the United States government infiltrated the Klan in the South in the 1950s and 60s and wiretapped the Klan. Liberals weren't too afraid of that because we like the FBI engaging in preemptive actions against the dreaded horrible Klan. But when they infiltrate other organizations, we get concerned. What I think we need is an objective jurisprudence which tells us where to draw the line in each case. Now, your caller said he doesn't know where to draw the line. Nobody knows where to draw the line.
But he's ready for the debate. He's ready for the effort. On the other hand, we see the potential for abuse at that same time.
There's no potential
you're
for abuse
bugging,
in having a debate.
Martin Luther King and you know all
and
kinds of
enemies.
And
let me tell you
lists.
Why that was done. Mm. Martin Luther King was bugged because we had no jurisprudence. We didn't have FISA in existence. And the Kennedy administration decided to bug Martin Luther King. The Roosevelt administration decided to confine 110,000 Japanese Americans in concentration camps. This is not liberal conservative. You pose a threat, we will act preemptively. But if you have a jurisprudence, it makes it harder to do.
Now we've got FISA, but of course we're blowing right past it, at least for now. Matt, thanks for your call. Jennifer's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Jennifer. You're on the air.
Hi. I think it becomes significantly more complicated if other countries adopted the same idea of jurisprudence for prevention and how we would make sense of it, given how different countries and cultures have, you know, different concepts of what's acceptable and risk, and how would the United States function in that capacity if everybody decided to do that? And
that's a perfect question. I'll give you an example. The Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, in their view, preemptively. They thought we were having a military naval buildup and we were about to attack them. They attacked us first. If we had found out about their plans to attack us, as of course some historians think we did, we would have been perfectly justified in attacking their air force on the ground before it attacked Pearl Harbor. But then they would have been justified in attacking our... You know, you can take preemption and go back and back and back, and you preempt the preemptors.
Isn't that why we've traditionally avoided it?
And that's why we should. That's why deterrence should remain the default position. But if Iran gets a nuclear bomb, for example, the fear is not that it's going to attack Israel or the United States. The fear is that it will give some of those nuclear weapons to terrorists to do their dirty work for them.
Of course, that's a backdoor attack. That is an attack.
But they won't have their fingerprints on it. We know that already. Pakistan, if a Nobel War Prize had to be given out, the worst person in the world today is this guy, Dr. Khan, who nuclear capacity to so many countries today. And that's the great danger. And if you can preempt that, there's going to be a temptation to do so. Your listeners might be interested in knowing how I got into this issue.
Well, I want to just—I heard Jennifer there for a moment.
Oh, sure.
Jennifer, you were pushing back, and I want to hear that.
Yeah, I just—I would be really skeptical of being able to evaluate different countries' motives, given that we can create our own intelligence information, and so I would just have no idea of how to make sense of what was going on internationally if everything was. We think that they were going to do this, and they think that they were going to do this, and that's why we think we should do. I mean,
and suddenly everybody's shooting off their six shooter.
You're absolutely right. And
I mean, Iran could say, "Well, Israel is an attack on the Ummah."
Iran has already said since Israel has a nuclear bomb, and since they already did attack Iraq in 1981, how do we know they won't attack us? We may have to attack them first. It's precisely because this kind of thinking exists that we need a jurisprudence to begin to constrain it. Without the jurisprudence, everybody just says we can act selfishly. We can act the way the professor from Texas said nations will always act outside of the rule of law. That's why we have Article 50 and 51. That's why we have the Bill of Rights.
But you're saying those are already obsolete. People already out of the boundaries all over the place.
That's right, because
what's going to keep them in the boundaries?
Because we have to create realistic approaches that look at deterrence. I think it might be interesting to know how I began this study.
Let me just thank Jennifer. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Alan, yes, please.
When I first started teaching in 1964, I noticed a very interesting phenomenon found there were nearly a million people in mental hospitals in the United States who were there preemptively and preventively because we thought they would commit crimes. We had a massive system of preventive detention to the mentally ill. And my first articles were all about building a jurisprudence for that. And we helped build a jurisprudence for that. And it resulted in deinstitutionalization of hundreds of thousands of mentally ill people because they couldn't be kept in once we had a jurisprudence.
But you're not liberating mentally ill people now. You're liberating armies.
The people of Guantanamo. My jurisprudence would never permit the kinds of things that are going on in Guantanamo. My jurisprudence would never permit the NSA data mining of the kind that's going on today. It would permit some on a basis that has to be proved. What's wrong with the NSA data mining, for example, is there are no records being kept as far as we know.
Right.
We don't know what we don't know.
They can be tapping you,
they
me, anybody.
They can be tapping me. Remember that Nixon tapped his political enemies and that Kennedy tapped Martin Luther King.
So we what about Guantanamo? What would you do in your jurisprudence? How would you settle that?
I would say that you can hold people based on what criteria they are, battlefield captives for a certain period of time, based on certain levels of suspicion. You can hold other people arrested in the United States for much shorter periods of time based on certain levels of suspicion. But you have to be able to see the light at the end of the tunnel. Everybody gets a lawyer. There has to be due process. There have to be criteria. That's what's lacking. We have a black hole in Guantanamo. Now, I want to replace that with a penal code, essentially, a jurisprudential approach to who we can hold and who we can't.
Aaron's calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Aaron. You're on the air.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for the show.
Sure.
Professor Dershowitz, thank you for bringing up this topic. I'm with you on most of the doctrine of developing a jurisprudence of preemption, and particularly domestically. My question is, though, don't we already have a jurisprudence of preemption internationally? I think Daniel Webster put it down, that it needs to be immediate, that there's no time for reflection, and that you kind of respond before the other person can get to
that
you.
That the threat is that imminent.
Yes, and that's the Caroline, that imminent, the famous... Right.
And what is the difference, then, between your doctrine of preemption, where does it end, and what you classified the Iraq War as prevention, and is that a line that's actually definable?
Good question.
It's a very great question. You're referring to, and I have a discussion of it in my book, Preemption, Daniel Webster's answer to the question put in the Caroline case, where he set out those criteria. Those criteria would not have allowed Britain and France to attack the German war-making machine in the 1930s, and I think most of us would think that would be a paradigm of where a dictator is planning to act aggressively, only probabilistically. We couldn't know with 100% certainty, but you never know with 100% certainty even after the fact. But there are cases where a preventive battle or a preventive attack would be justified. There are cases where a preemptive attack would be justified. What we need to do is, instead of leaving it nation by nation to the self, because remember, nations will always exaggerate the threat to them and underrate the dangers to others. But
so who's going to define it or decide it in your model?
Well, first of all, what we need is scholars starting to address this problem. I think my book Preemption is a first step, obviously, but not a last step.
But Hitler could line up any scholars he wanted to justify whatever attack he wanted.
But, you know, it's so interesting that when you have a rule of law, we know when people violate the rule of law. We know when they don't. We now have international courts that can make some of those decisions. We do have a United Nations. We have international common law that we look to.
So would the U.S. have to go to the Security Council? You're talking the U.N. adopting jurisprudence?
In fact, there is, as I write in Preemption, there's now a new suggestion that's being put forward by the United Nations saying that for preemptive war, if it's imminent, you don't have to go to the United Nations. But for preventive war, you do have to go to the Security Council. That's a step forward.
And how do you define that line, Aaron is asking?
If it's imminent and if there is no time, it's like self-defense. If somebody's coming at you with a gun, you have the right to shoot him first. But if somebody has threatened you merely, you have to go to the police.
Aaron,
that
is that good
works.
Enough? Aaron?
Yeah. May I ask just one other question?
Please.
I think, again, on the international level, you had stated earlier, look, no state at some point is going to put its national security behind a general jurisprudence, whether established by professors or otherwise. To what degree do you think establishing a jurisprudence of, prevention starts to undermine law itself because it is so widely and so notably ignored in certain very great cases?
You can ask the same question. Yeah.
Are you saying, Aaron, that it would effectively sanction preemption and thereby encourage it?
No, I'm thinking of the effect on law generally, that I think people look at the Iraq War and they say, you know what, there was international law, the United States ignored it, and that tends to reinforce the sense of realpolitik, that law has no place here, and that is it too early, in fact, to start saying we have a jurisprudence of preemption? Could that, in fact, undermine the place of law in areas where
and
it
I think
actually
Aaron,
a very
a
good
great
point. Thought, and thanks
and
for your
can,
call, Alan.
And you can make the same point about the domestic law of self-defense. For example, Florida has just changed its domestic law of self-defense, saying if somebody comes at you and you can easily retreat, run away, you're in the car, say, and he only has a knife, you don't have to retreat. You can stand your ground and shoot. And that's a terrible, terrible mistake. But nonetheless, the law of self-defense would never affect my conduct if somebody's coming at me with a gun or a knife. I'm going to do whatever I can to save my life. But we spend much time trying to figure out the intricacies of what an appropriate law of self-defense should be, because we think we can, at the margins, influence people's behavior. Even the Iraq War, which I think is a disaster, the United States didn't go into it the day they wanted to. They did go to the UN. They did try to get justification for it. I think it was a farce in the end, but the very fact that they sought the cover of law shows that even great nations will sometimes try to come within the law when the law corresponds to their own self-interest. And
but
in
it ended up being
cases,
essentially
Mike
the cover and not
withhold.
The... I mean, half the UN thought they hadn't even given sanction for this. So
and
cover may have been the encouragement.
And, you know, two-thirds of the United States Senate don't think that when they authorized the president to take whatever actions were necessary, that they authorized him to go and do national security data mining. That's a conversation that has to occur in a democracy. And that's a conversation that's occurring at the UN. At least there's a basis for having the conversation when we have a law. When we just say this is a phenomenon out there and we'll let people use it whenever they
ad
want
hoc,
preemption.
Ad hoc.
Ad hoc. Doesn't work.
Yusuf is calling from Washington. Hi, Yusuf. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes. I disagree with the notion of, I guess, quote, preemption right now against what is deemed terrorism. I mean, first of all, I think it's stupid to attempt to fight a tactic. I mean, that's saying like you want to go to war against bad manners.
But 9/11 was deemed terrorism, but we saw that the death toll was pretty high.
How can you compare bad manners to terrorism? I don't get it.
Well, it's a tactic. It's a behavior.
It's a tactic that kills innocent people,
well,
and it's a wrong tactic,
well,
and it's something that we have the right to prevent if
yes,
we can.
It's relative. If you agree with the politics on the other side, it's called covert operations and secret ops.
So where are you going with this, Yusuf?
Well, I'm going with it is that I think a better approach with respect to taking care of the issue at hand is not just labeling people terrorists, you know, but trying to engage them with respect to standard of living.
There's absolutely no evidence to show that terrorists with a high standard of living don't become terrorists. The people who put 9/11 forward were rich, educated people. That's a myth.
Do you categorize terrorists as the people in Israel, you know, that committed atrocities?
I knew you were going there. Somehow I knew you were going there.
And Professor Dershowitz over the last few years has had a very increasingly right-leaning Israel at all costs.
You have no idea what my philosophy is and how it's changed over the years. You're just doing an ad hominem
attack. How is that relevant here, Yusuf?
But I knew you were going there.
How is that relevant, Yusuf?
Because I question Professor Dershowitz's motives. I mean, it tends to fit. He will go anywhere and espouse anything that supports Zionism, wherever that
And you will go anywhere and do anything that undercuts Zionism and undercuts Israel's right to exist. So let's ignore that subject and talk about how we get reasonable rules that say that when a person is about to try to plant a bomb, blowing up hundreds of people in a city, that you have the right to try to get him before he gets you.
We hear that. And Yusuf, I thank you for your call. Let me just go with that, because you have a lot of reference to Israel in the book, Preemption.
Right.
Is there a difference in scale between the United States and Israel? I mean, Israel is so small that its existence is much more vulnerable than American existence.
Absolutely, and I think you have to take into account
triangulating off of two vulnerable, I don't know, an example,
no,
an
and
illustration.
I say explicitly, you can't learn from one model of one small country that doesn't really have access to the Security Council of the United Nations and generalize to another country, and that's why, although Israel has used preemption, sometimes successfully, successfully, sometimes not successfully. 67, yes, successfully. 82, the war in Lebanon is a disaster. I think 56 was a disaster. So I'm not always supporting Israel. I'm very critical of some of Israel's preemptive policies. But the United States, being the superpower, have to have its own constraints, many more constraints on American actions than on the actions of any small country.
And when I go back to this issue of liberties, we've, over the years, since 9/11, we've had so many callers saying, I care so much about American liberties, I am willing to live with a considerable degree of risk, because if I give those up, what's the world I live in?
Let me give you the answer to that. As a civil libertarian, I want to make sure there are no more terrorist attacks on the United States. Why? Because I think the greatest threat to civil liberties today is a renewed terrorist attack, another 9/11, a biological attack, a chemical attack. That's why civil libertarians ought to be on the forefront of preventing terrorists from destroying our civil liberties.
But talk about a knife that cuts both ways.
That's right, but we have to do it consistent with the Bill of Rights. We have to take a lead and say we as civil libertarians are to tell you this is the way to fight terrorism effectively, not to take Yusuf's position that there are no such things as terrorists. There are just different views. Terrorism is a terrible threat to civil liberties in two ways. The terrorists themselves and our government in constraining civil liberties. If we take a more active lead in trying to build a jurisprudence, we can attack terrorism and maintain the Bill of Rights and civil liberties. That's my goal in writing the book Preemption, A Knife That Cuts Both Ways.
There's the tension. Let me get one more call. Bill is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hello, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm very disturbed to hear Mr. Dershowitz continually setting up Iran as a possible target for preemption by implying that Iran might bomb Israel when Iran has no nuclear weapons, and actually stating incorrectly that Iran attacked Iraq. It was not Iran that attacked Iraq in the Iran-Iraq war. Iraq started the war. Iran has not attacked anyone for the last 300 years.
Okay, let me just correct
Bill
your facts.
Beeman at Brown University, Professor Beeman.
You're just totally wrong. Do you remember Osirik in 1981? Israel destroyed the Osirik nuclear reactor.
In Iraq.
Guess who attacked the nuclear reactor first, several months earlier? Iran attacked the same nuclear reactor, tried to destroy it, tried to claim that there were Israeli planes who did it. They were caught. They failed. Iran did attack Iraq in the Osirik reactor just before Israel did it. So you just have your facts wrong.
Bill Beeman at Brown University, what do you think of the push for a new framework, a new jurisprudence for preemption, the big push here?
I think that it's always very dangerous to take a preemptive strike, particularly when you have to justify it after the fact. Mm-hmm. And in a situation where Iran might be the preemptive strike, it would set off a conflagration throughout the Middle East that would not stop until our great-grandchildren were dead.
I don't disagree with that. I'm against a preemptive attack in Iran. I hope that the Russian taking on the role that they've taken on could stop it. I hope diplomatic efforts could
but
stop it.
But in the end, would you move
would
to
not
preempt
take it off
to
the
prevent
table.
Nuclear?
I would not take off the table a preemptive attack if it could be done safely as a last recourse to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. I would hope we wouldn't have to reach that, and I would hope if it had to be done, it could be done multilaterally, not by just the United States or Israel or even in combination. But an Iran with nuclear weapons today is an unacceptable situation in the world, I believe.
Our time is short, Bill Beeman. Thanks for calling in. Ellen Dershowitz, we've just got half a minute here.
Mm-hmm.
Back to Zbigniew Brzezinski saying again, we've got to address underlying issues in the world. Do you risk pushing the sort of emphasis in international relations to military interaction if you build this framework for preemption? Does it take the ball off underlying tensions?
I don't think that we can address underlying tensions in my lifetime or your lifetime. The differences between those who would go to war over a cartoon and those who would not are so deep and so serious that I do not think we will change the way Islamic extremists think about America in our lifetime. Therefore, we have to be prepared for a preventive military option if necessary.
There's the case. Alan Dershowitz, professor of law at Harvard Law School, author of the new book, Preemption, A Knife That Cuts Both Ways. Professor Dershowitz, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.